Blockbus.net Podcast Network.
To a brand spanking new edition of Five and Out. I'm Wes.
I'm Steve.
And this week we have a very artistic top five for you. What is that top five, Steve?
We are talking about our top five favorite stage to screen films.
And no spoilers, but there are some surprises in there.
Ooh!
Well, we got a lot of show to get to, so let's get to it.
Wes, when was the last song or CD or album or something that you just got locked deep in your head and just could not get it out?
Oh, it happened yesterday.
Yeah.
I watched Moana for the first time. And the song How Far I'll Go.
It's awesome.
It's great, but it's stuck in my head. And the worst part is I don't know the lyrics. So I'm just going around the house be like, da 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 da.
And no one knows how far it goes. The first time I watched Moana, I was like, this is pretty good. That's not bad. It's cute. I like the chicken. I like the pig. We're all good.
Yeah, the two big takeaways.
Do you know who does the voice for the chicken?
Jerry Seinfeld.
You seriously don't know
that? No, I don't.
It's Alan Tudyk.
Is it really?
It's Alan Tudyk, yeah.
No way!
Yeah. Yes.
I. You know what? I knew he was in the movie. And it didn't even occur to me that, like, oh, I had no idea what part he played.
Yeah, he's been in the last, like, six Pixar movies or something like that.
Yeah.
And, like, really small things. Yeah. So the chicken is Alan Tudyk. But, yes, after I watched it, that song and You're Welcome.
You're Welcome!
Yeah. Those two songs got locked in my head for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I am currently, and this is a perfect segue, because this is a musical. On stage, which will lead into our top five later, and it also is written by the same guy who wrote Moana. That's Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yes.
I am deep in Hamilton right now.
Oh, yeah.
I saw the play like a year, actually right after my daughter was born, so roughly nine-ish months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, so that's a very well-done play. The music is great. It's really very, very good. I respect it.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm, like, I'm just locked into the music. I've been listening to it, like, nonstop for the last week.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, my God, it's so fucking good!
Because I've only listened to the soundtrack once all the way through and then snippets here and there. But even just that, like, I feel like every time you listen to it, you start noticing more and more of the artistry behind it.
Absolutely, man. It is so lyrically dense.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing, like, the way they layer the like the same like little riff that you'll hear in like the second song comes back again very minorly in like a fifth song that comes back to wrap it up. Like it's
like a lyrical onion, really.
Hamilton, the lyrical onion. It's just excellent.
Yes.
I'm just so, and like I'm listening to it so much that I'm purposely trying to listen to other stuff. And then I'll put it on and be like, no one knows, and Hamilton. And I'm back to Hamilton.
Have you ever listened to In the Heights?
I've never listened to In the Heights.
That's also a good one.
It is also Lin-Manuel Miranda, right?
Yes.
Did he write that as well or just perform it?
I have no idea.
All right.
And there's no way to find out.
Impossible.
Yeah, dude. He's a talented guy.
Yeah, and I think I was going to like the music in Moana more.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know like it was this big, like, oh, Lin-Manuel Miranda, oh, this is going to be amazing. And I think it's the same thing with Moana as well. The first time I was like, yeah, okay, this is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just a thing that I kind of happened to have on a couple of times because, like, all right, Cobra Jones is here. We'll just throw this on in the background. And then I kind of listened to it a little more the next time. I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, my God, is this another onion?
Another lyrical onion?
Oh, my God, I'm surrounded by musical onions.
Short answer, yes, it is.
It's good.
It's good, man.
But you know what? I was really excited after I watched Moana because there's a version of You're Welcome that isn't sang by The Rock. It's sang by Lin-Manuel Miranda and this other guy. I was like, oh, nice. A better vocalist than The Rock singing that song. Not as good.
Really?
Not as good. Takes the, like, the energy of the song away. It's not as good.
I agree. The energy isn't the energy isn't there like the when The Rock does it, but I really liked the music.
No, no, no. Like the energy is there when The Rock does it.
That's what I tried to say, but I screwed up because I don't know words. But I really enjoy listening to the two harmonize together.
Yeah, yeah. There's some pros, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's why you're having such a hard time singing the song, because you're so bad with words.
I don't know words.
You're la, la, la.
We just talked about how I don't know any lyrics to Moana except You're Welcome.
Yep.
And I just sing sounds.
Yeah, I have to say, if this was an episode of Family Guy, we would cut right now to you doing your musical audition piece. That's just really complex humming and then like Scatman stuff.
Yeah. So you get me. And
obviously,
what better thing for a man who doesn't know words to do than an audio podcast?
Obviously. Mm-hmm. All the stars are coming into alignment right
That's
now.
Right.
So speaking of things that are deep in your head, last week, I've been thinking about this a lot. Wes and I have embarked on playing the new VR game, Resident Evil 7 Biohazard.
Oh my god, it is so freaky. Oh, did you mention that we're playing it in VR?
That's the big thing.
Yeah.
Playing it in virtual reality.
Oh god, it is terrifying.
So, we had mentioned before on our previous VR quest that part of the problem with virtual reality is that the previous games, you're either stationary or you kind of teleport from one place to the next, and you can't really move your character. In Resident Evil, you will be, so you can move your head with the headset, and you can look around a corner, you can aim your gun with your head, mm-hmm. and then you use the controller in your regular DualShock controller to move you around the environment, which actually, it works pretty well.
It takes some of the immersiveness out of it at first until you get used to it.
Yeah.
Because I really like games like Superhot, where you are ducking and diving and you're throwing stuff and you're aiming with your hands and, you know, I agree. I kind of wish that it had some of that built in.
I mean, except for having like a treadmill floor, you know, like there's.
Oh, do you like my new treadmill floor?
Which, by the way, it is wonderful.
Thank you.
You've been looking thinner.
Thank you. I'm skin and bones.
I think if the choice is using the DualShock controller to move yourself around or having to do like a teleport style thing, I'd much rather the DualShock controller for this game.
You know what? You have a point, because the teleportation thing for this game would take away all the scares.
Yeah, absolutely. So this game is the, we were, what, maybe 6 hours into it, something like that?
Around there.
Around
I feel
there.
Like we're not even halfway.
No, and also we realized, too, that the VR experience makes the game take a lot longer. Not in a bad way.
Yeah.
But when we've all played a million video games and you walk into, like, a kitchen or whatever, and you're like, all right, check cabinets real quick, anything under the table? Here we go, garbage can, no, anything? Okay, we're out.
Mm-hmm.
And in VR, because it's kind of this Texas Chainsaw Massacre mansion kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's decrepit. It's run down. There's, like, disgusting old food around.
Mm-hmm.
And both Wes and I, when we're playing, we're in the we open up the fridge and we kind of duck down to look in. And you're like, ew!
It's so gross!
Look at the expiration date on this milk!
Oh, God! It's so curdled!
So the whole process is more in-depth and more real. And that's why it takes longer, because you're like, I don't want to go over there.
I was going to say, like, that's the big thing. What makes this game great in VR is because it's all about the experience of you being in this creepy-ass Louisiana house.
Yeah.
And what's the word I'm looking for? The environment, the ambiance is so terrifying that you don't want to go around the next corner.
Yeah,
you want to leave as fast as you can.
So this is not a spoiler. This is anyone who has played a Resident Evil game will know this part of the game is coming, where some sort of weird monster appears.
Oh, spoiler.
Cats out of the bag. So the thing that's been in my head is this experience Wes and I had last week when we were playing, is that we kind of get down into the basement and you see this kind of like almost looks like a tree root that's kind of grown through the foundation and looks kind of like moldy almost.
I called it like a black swamp thing.
Yeah, yeah. Because then, of course, this root thing comes to life and it looks like an afro swamp thing.
Yeah.
Or it looks kind of like Swamp Thing mixed with the character Venom. Is what it kind of looks like. And Wes is playing, and he comes across the first one and screams like a little girl.
Yes.
And he starts shooting it, and it won't die. So it takes a swipe, and Wes ducks under his arm, and he runs. I'm like, there's a room there! There's a room there! So Wes goes over, and he opens the door, and he gets in the next room. So I'm sitting on the couch, and I can see the television. I can see what Wes is seeing in his headset. So Wes opens the door, and in real life, he turns his head and the headset to the right, and he's looking about chest high into another one of these Venom things. And Wes, in real life, you see him crane his neck upwards as he just looks to the ceiling, and I can see it on the screen that he looks directly into the face of this thing, and it promptly kills him.
It and I screamed like a frightened child.
It was, I mean... It reminded me of, like, a little kid, like, turning the corner and, like, running into the waist of his dad and then slowly panning up, be like, I'm in deep shit. So then Wes dies, so I put the headset on. Since now I know it's there, I kill the dudes. I go into the next room, there's another guy, and I shoot, like, a leg off or something. I think I kill him, and I start to walk over the top, and he grabs my leg. I'm like, ah! So I open the door. And as soon as I open the door, there's one to my right, one to my left, and I'm like, and I don't have enough bullets to kill them. So I go, oh! And I start sprinting to the door in the corner. And as I'm sprinting, another one, another two, they emerge. I'm like, ah! And they, like, swipe, and one gets me and doesn't kill me. And I get to the door, I'm like... And Wes is screaming from behind. He's like, open the door! Open the door!
Steve is pushing all the buttons frantically.
And it says, you do not have the key to open this door. I'm like, ah! So I turn. At this point, I don't stop screaming because I am legitimately terrified. So I turn back and all four of them are there. Luckily, the room is kind of in the shape of a circle. And I just start sprinting, going, ah, 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 ah. And I make it back out of the room into another room, and I'm like hyperventilating, and I'm sweating inside the VR thing, and I'm like, I'm not going back in there.
It was great. Yeah, man, like an experience like that. In game would be stressful without the VR because, oh my god, you're about to die. But when you're in that world, you're in that world.
Yeah, that was my first, I think, legitimate moment of VR really, really escalating something else that I don't think would have been as cool as you said without the VR. It was so fun. This game has been worth it just for that moment alone. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, sure. And like you said, we're 6 hours in, but I feel like if we were playing it normally, we'd only be 2.5 hours most.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And be like, all right, you just go in, shoot that one, come around this way. And here you're like, I don't think you should go back in. maybe we could just go back to the beginning of the game and try to jump our car.
Yeah, and ram it into the house.
I don't know. Do you have an Uber app in the game? Can we just leave?
Yeah, yeah. So are you ready to play it again after we're done with the podcast?
No.
Well, along with a Resident Evil 7, I'm also playing this indie game called This War of Mine, The Little Ones, which you saw a little bit of and you really dug.
I mean, I saw a very little bit of it.
You saw you saw about 5 seconds. You're like, okay, cool, I got it.
Yeah, it's was kind of like base building and... And what you explain it. You're the one playing.
Yeah, yeah. No, Steve, I want to hear you explain it, but based on the 5 seconds that you saw.
So what I saw here is a little Hispanic plumber guy. he's Italian. Whatever. Some sort of little Italian guy with some overalls. I saw some mushrooms and I don't know. There's turtles and stuff.
He's got a pet lizard.
I know, there's a war.
Oh,
I don't know.
Boy.
I don't know. You build a base.
Yeah, exactly.
All of a sudden, you're the god of war, and then you collect some rings, you know.
Yeah, and then you save Hyrule, and Princess Zelda does not kiss you.
That's it.
That's the game.
I think we've all played it.
Yep. So this game, it's set in a fictional country during a fake war. You play this band of refugees, and they're holed up in this mansion. It's kind of split up into like a day and then a night cycle. During the day cycle, you feed everybody, you patch them up, and then you build workshops to make everyone more self-sufficient. And during the night is when you go out and scavenge for food and parts and whatnot. And two things you should know. One, you can only go to one location per night. And you cannot go back to the house to, say, if you, in this location, you need, like, a crowbar to get something open. You can't go back to the house to grab a crowbar because then the next day would just start. Night would be over. Next day would begin. So.
A singular raiding mission.
Exactly. So I, about day four, day five, and people are already very hungry because I ran out of food.
So, great leader.
Yep. I'm a master. So I go to this building, and it's owned by this man, and he's got a sick dad, and he wants to trade for medication. I don't have any medication on me, and I can't go back, and we need food, and they have food. So I'm like, I do what any other video gamer would do. I have the guy murder the poor man and his sick father, and then I raid their stuff, and I bring it back. A mechanic I didn't know was in the game. So under the profiles of everybody, there's like status effects like hungry, tired. The new status effect was mentally broken. He walks in, collapses to his knees, and starts sobbing. And then this sends everybody else into this severe depression.
Wow.
That I'm on now, I think I'm around day 18 or 19. Everybody is still depressed, and I'm like, I'm sorry! I didn't know this was a thing!
And I would love if the NPCs were like, really, Wes? You didn't know murdering people could have a psychological effect on someone? Way to go, leader!
I didn't know that I'd need to worry about your mental health as well as your physical health. I'm sorry, tell me how to fix it. And then at the beginning of every day, there's a status update about what happened during the night. Like the night was calm, or we were attacked, or whatever. I think a day or two in-game, like a day or two ago in-game, the message was, nobody could sleep last night because Marco couldn't stop sobbing. And again, I'm sitting here, I'm sorry!
I imagine the next status effect is Marco is dehydrated because he's been crying for 7 days.
Tell me how to fix you.
Bring them back to life.
I can't.
Then I will sob.
Oh, God.
Marco.
And now, again, day 19 around there. We're running out of food. There's no bullets because we keep getting raided.
Well, here's the thing. The good thing is you already know your murderer in your group, so just bring out Cryy Marco. Marco, that guy's got some food. I need you. But I don't. Kill him, Marco.
But I don't want to.
You've done it before, haven't you, Marco?
You made me, you monster.
Then I'm going to make you do it again. Marco continues to sob.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I'm totally into playing this game. But it's like $25 on Steam right now.
Yeah.
And you got it for free on PlayStation Network, right?
I did.
Yeah. I'll pay... This sounds like a $6 game to me.
Sure.
Yeah. That's where the bar's set.
Sure, sure, sure. I'm starting to wonder... I was wondering this today.
Am I a bad person?
Am I awful? No, I turned off the game, and I wondered, am I having fun? Is this fun? Because it feels an awful lot like crippling anxiety.
Or do I just turn on this crying simulator for a couple of hours and feel bad about myself? Which has value.
Sure.
I mean, you know, if you're looking for that kind of thing.
And I was thinking, man, if this is fun, I have had a low-level generalized fun disorder for most of my life.
It's a good thing you haven't seen any good stand-ups in a while. They would literally make your head explode.
Oh, God.
I thought Margo killing people and being horribly depressed was funny. This guy's hilarious!
Why can't I stop hyperventilating?
Wow, sounds like you've had some personal demons in the gaming world.
Oh, man, I feel so bad.
Wow.
So, there you go, man.
No wonder I'm excited to play this game. Like, yeah, ruin Marco.
Because as you said before we turned on the mics, you're a total and complete asshole.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
100%, except around my daughter. Then I'm just moderately a butthole.
Moderately a boothole.
You know, try to clean it up for the kids.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know.
So anything else going on? Watching anything? Playing anything?
I just watched a totally obscure random movie. It's called Shoot 'Em Up. With Clive Owen.
I remember that one.
From back in the day.
Yeah.
I was just looking for a ridiculous action with a touch of comedy, and I was like, oh, wait, it's exactly what this thing is.
Yeah.
And what's her name? The woman that is in Matrix Reloaded.
Carrie Ann Moss.
That's not it.
Ooh.
She's so beautiful. I can't think of her name. She is in...
Carrie Ann Moss.
That's the one. Just... Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful woman that's in the movie, and not bad on the eye candy.
Was that your whole point?
Yeah, she's super hot. I can't think of her name. Okay, gotta do it. Gotta do it. Gotta look it up.
Gotta do a TV timeout.
Wes, could you please sing a song from Moana for me?
Do ba do 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 ba do 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 ba do 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 do. Did you look it up? Okay, TV timeout.
Monica Bellucci.
Ah, Carrie Ann Moss.
Monica Carrie Ann Bellucci Moss.
That's correct.
She is gorgeous, Wes. Absolutely gorgeous. And a 10.
Great. Is she single?
And waiting for you, my friend.
Yeah.
I mean, I gotta take a second, Wes. She's... Please.
Steve, do you need to lie down?
I'm thinking about Monica Bellucci. I'm getting all hot and bothered over here. Do you know what she looks like?
I just looked her up.
And how you feeling?
I mean, she's a very pretty lady.
I mean, how pretty?
She's a 10. Is that what you want to hear?
Yeah, I think she's more than a 10.
Okay.
You know, Wes, you're right. Let me one up you.
Yeah, I think she's an 11, Wes. How do you feel about that, you bastard?
She's just one of those women that you're like, wow. Wow. A wow.
So,
you know.
Steve, your head just turned into a wolf's head. You started howling.
Yeah, that's what she does to me, man. She's gorgeous.
Wow, that's great. Thank How's you. Her acting? Is she smart?
Subpar.
Oh, okay.
Subpar at best.
Oh, wonderful.
But I'll tell you what, she's more than a 10 in the looks department, so you can kind of move a couple over to acting. It's good enough.
This isn't a D&D character sheet, Steve. You can't just pick and choose.
She rolled a 30 for looks. Out of 10.
All right. Well, we have to get to... We're already running long, and we haven't even begun from emails from last podcast.
Oh, my.
So
Monica Bellucci wrote in.
Exactly. She's like, Wes, I'm single and waiting for you. And tell Steve to fuck off.
Ah! Bellucci!
So, actually, I want to address a question. We got this question a lot. Are... What? Who do you guys think you are? No, the real question was, are Netflix reviews coming back? And I want to address this. We just brought this back. Let us get this going every 2 weeks. It's not out of the cards, but right now we're just mainly focused on getting this going for a few months. And then
I'll tell you what, Wes. Netflix is right for the picking right now. There's a whole bunch of shit sandwiches out there.
Yes, somebody mentioned that there's like 4 more Deathstalker movies for me to...
What?
Yeah, the legendary Netflix review of Deathstalker.
There are more?
There are more.
Netflix reviews are coming back.
Oh, God. But yes, possibly in the future, but don't look for it in the next few weeks
tonight.
Or so.
Possibly tonight.
Possibly tonight. For those of you who don't know, I don't even know if you can find it online anymore. We did these Netflix reviews, and Deathstalker, this is one of Steve's favorite Netflix reviews because this was the first time something legitimately broke me.
That's so good. And if you've never seen Deathstalker, continue that. Don't watch it. Do not watch it.
I gave it, on our patented 1 to 100 scale, I gave it a 5.
That is dangerous Prometheus levels right there.
I know. And you gave it, what, a 20 or something like that? And I got so mad at you.
I believe the direct quote was, a 20? How can you give that a what?
Yeah, I think that's the direct quote. And then I think I followed up with, no, you aren't.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
It just makes me so happy. That's the maddest I've ever seen you.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So, yes. So, probably in the future, yes, Netflix reviews will be coming back. But right now, we are talking about Five and Out, and our last podcast was Five and Out Bookends, or prequels and sequels to existing TV, video games, and movie properties. And Ben Birdwhistle. I'm guessing it's Birdwhistle, maybe Birdwistel. We'll never know. So his top five is a prequel and sequel to the current Wolfenstein series.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I like that. You know what? I recently downloaded, I know you played it, right? The one for PS3.
Wolfenstein, the new order.
New order. I believe you're right. Downloaded on my computer. Would not run it for some reason. There's some sort of weird thing where that game won't run on my graphics card. Ugh. I was like, fuck you.
Yeah.
So I still haven't played it.
Oh, dude, it's so good. And that's a killer number five, dude. Number four, to Undercover Brother. His explanation. I think there is more to mine for making fun of 70s blaxploitation films. The prequel could be set in the late 70s or early 80s when the original wave of films were dying out, and the sequel can be about where Undercover Brother, or the sequel can be about where Undercover Brother fits in with the new wave of insane racists and the revival of blaxploitation culture.
Hmm. Wow.
I've never seen it.
Neither have I.
I cannot comment on it.
Okay.
But, so I'll just say.
I'll say, nice number four.
Yeah, nice number four. Number three is Dragon Age. Have you played any of the Dragon Ages?
I've not played any, because I have to be very careful with those kind of games.
Yeah.
Because they just eat the time.
Oh, yeah. I remember I played Dragon Age Inquisition. Dragon Age 2? One of the Dragon Ages. Total time suck. And I wound up dropping 40 hours into it, and I made it two-thirds of the way through the game, and I realized that I had been leveling up my characters wrong from the very beginning. So
I need bigger pockets.
Yeah, exactly.
Level my pockets up.
We need to take another point or two in cosmetics. So, good number three.
And I imagine you having some sort of orc-like character, like, oh, yeah, hideously ugly all of the time. Like, just slap a little lipstick on this baby, little eyeliner. Then that princess will be mine.
Ooh, a little perfume, a little deer pheromone. You know.
And Monica Bellucci is mine.
Oh, yeah. His number two is DuckTales.
Woo!
Yep. I was never super into DuckTales.
I was into DuckTales, but I don't remember enough of a narrative of DuckTales to be like, I have got to finish out. I got to really flesh out the story of Scrooge McDuck over here.
His explanation is prequel can be a young Scrooge in his prime, arrogant, rich, cocky, and no brats. The sequel can be wholly about Huey, Dewey, and Louie as adult adventurers with Scrooge maybe in a Bruce Wayne and Batman Beyond position, just basically at the back computer.
Huh.
Which could be interesting.
Yeah.
You remain unconvinced.
Correct. Correct. I mean, if I'm going to be looking for, you know, kind of the playboy mentality of something, like, I'm not really looking for an animated duck to show me the way, you know? Like, I'm looking for someone that looks kind of like, you know, Bruce Wayne or something to show me the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the prequel to DuckTales is basically The Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah. Starring Scrooge McDuck. Yeah. I think Leonardo DiCaprio did it just fine. That's me.
Sure. All right, his number one, a prequel and sequel to Son of the Mask.
Wait, what?
/ The Mask.
I was going to say, there already is one. It's called The Mask.
He says, the first Mask movie is great.
It
agreed.
Is great. And actually, all-time hot, Cameron Diaz from The Mask.
Oh, totally.
Oh, my God.
The second one is one of the worst movies ever made.
Right.
Agreed.
Yes.
The prequel can take place after the first one and maybe give us one final Mask adventure with Jim Carrey in it somehow. The sequel is much easier. The Mask comes back, but no Loki, Jamie Kennedy, Mask CG Baby, or anything from Son of the Mask. Start fresh. Maybe let a lady wear the mask. The bookends will help me forget Son of the Mask ever happened.
Nice.
He just wants two more Mask movies.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
Which is fine. That is one movie, though, that I'm okay with. Because in my mind, Son of the Mask doesn't even exist.
No.
I don't, like, this is the first time I've thought about that movie in 10 years.
And damn you, Ben.
Damn it, Ben. But if they were to say, like, we're going to reboot the Mask, you know, into a franchise with whoever as the guy, I'd be like, can't you just leave it alone? Like, it's not a good enough movie to be like, we're bringing it back.
Yeah.
I feel like nobody will ever nail that like Jim Carrey nailed that. You know, it'll all just be an impression of Jim Carrey.
Oh, sure.
But if you actually got Jim Carrey to do it in a sequel, I'd be okay.
Jim Carrey nowadays?
I mean, I'm trying to help Ben out over here.
Okay. Okay. All right, fine.
All right. If you could have done a Mask sequel around the time of The Mask with that Jim Carrey,
yeah.
With that, like, in the Ace Ventura Jim Carrey.
Oh, The Mask When Nature Calls?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just writes itself. And this must be the Monopoly guy. Just slap the mask on him. It'll be great.
Yeah, totally. All right, Ben, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for writing in. We apologize. We only have time to read one, but we have to move into this week's top five, which is, Steve, what is this week's top five?
We are doing our top five favorite stage-to-screen adaptations.
Ooh, and there are a lot, and I challenged myself to not do musicals.
Oh. Well, I didn't.
I failed on one.
Okay.
Okay.
So, again, Wes and I both have degrees in theater.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun to be able to bring some of the – talk about some of the stuff that has gone from stage to the screen and what makes that that transition – Sammy, man. Sorry. Excuse me. That was my puppy dog over here. it's fun to talk about what things translate well, and which ones should be left to the stage, which ones should be left to the screen.
And you can hear much smarter people talk about that on other podcasts.
Right.
Yeah.
We're just a bunch of jackholes.
Who do we think we are?
Who do you think you are? I can never hear that phrase and not think about the scene from The Office with Michael and Toby. And do you know the scene I'm talking about?
Refresh my memory.
Long story short, it's when Michael is going to, like, when Toby's leaving and he's doing the exit interview with Michael, but then the love of his life, Holly, sits in on it. So now all these questions he'd written to ask Toby about just, like, laying it on Toby, he has to reword. The first question is, who do you think you are?
Yeah.
Anywho, Wes, why don't you start us off?
I'm going to start us off with an old classic. Number five, Arsenic and Old Lace.
Whoa!
Yeah. How about that?
How about that?
It's a dark comedy by Joseph Kesselring. I realize now most of these on here... No, never mind. I about said most of these on here I've been in before. No, that's false.
Wrong. I've never... been in anything.
That's right. My degree in theater completely wasted. So I know this show because I did it in high school. I played the evil Jonathan Brewster.
Ooh.
And for those of you who don't know, it's about the protagonist, Mortimer Brewster, comes home to visit his aunts, and he finds out that his aunts love to poison and kill lonely old men.
Oh.
And then his evil, murderous brother comes in with his crazy German sidekick. And this play is just a delight. And why I think it makes a great switch from stage to screen is because it's... I feel like it's the material is there. And I think it was made in the 40s anyway, so there didn't need to be a lot of special effects.
Right.
Because of, you know, it's... a movie about relationships at the end
right.
of the day. So That's my number five, Arsenic and Old Lace.
Okay. When did the movie come out?
I think in 1946.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know,
wow,
okay. Not a lot of special effects or 3D.
No, I would. Are we going to see this one with a VR headset on?
Oh, totally.
Okay, okay. Wow, that is a surprise pick.
I know, right?
I think this might be a surprise pick for you as well. My number five.
Rent!
Is Frost Nixon.
That's my number four!
Is it really?
Yes!
Oh, well, then it's not surprising at all. So, Frost Nixon, again, in this world that I oftentimes I get fed up with of huge CGI, huge explosions, sequel, all this, Frost Nixon is two guys sitting at two chairs talking.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so engaging.
Mm-hmm.
So this is David Frost and Richard Nixon is the retelling of an interview after Nixon was just left the office of president. And it's the stakes are huge. It's there's no special effects. There's no green screen. It is two fantastic actors at the top of their game with just meaty dialogue and playing with status. And it's a great movie that just clips. Like, if you're going to say, this is two old white dudes talking, you're like... Great. This baby moves and it clips. It's really good. And it was a highly, highly regarded stage play as well, nominated for several Tonys.
I don't know anything about the stage play. Is it kind of, is it a lot like the movie, or is it a two-person show?
It's a two-person show.
Okay.
Obviously in the movie, they don't just plunk two dudes down on a black screen, you know, and just let them go. And it's in a living room setup in the movie. And I've never seen the actual stage play itself, because I think it was only on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who plays Richard Nixon is Frank Langella, who is an amazing actor. I think he won the Tony for this, actually.
Oh, really?
And then he gave a kick-ass speech when he won it as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's been nominated for a bunch of Tonys, so that may be incorrect. But, I'm pretty sure that the stage production is just the two dudes on the stage. I don't know what the scenic background is to it, but it's really good. It's really, really good.
What I really liked about this adaptation is that during the interview sequences, it's almost filmed like a boxing match.
Yeah, like a tennis match. Yeah.
Especially the final one where, you know, I think the effect happened a couple times where, like, people are coming in and out of focus. You know, you were just decked with a question and suddenly everything's out of focus and you're like trying to focus back in. And yeah, it was like super cool. A lot of cool camera effects.
Yeah. It's just to see two really good actors working at like doing their craft, you know, without a lot of extra stuff. This is a great example of that. So, Frost Nixon, it's my number five.
Well, shit. That's my number four. So I will throw in an honorable mention. It's an honorable mention because it's a musical. And I haven't seen it since it came out 17 years ago. It's the movie, this might take one of yours, Chicago.
It's not on my list.
Cool. I remember really liking this when this came out. I had the pleasure of doing the show back in the day. And I really liked the musical. And I remember, again, really liking the movie.
And it also won Best Picture.
It did.
Like 2002, I think.
That's always not the mark of quality.
No.
But.
No, it's not.
It was a solid adaptation.
No, I feel like if you win the Best Picture Oscar, you've got an 80% chance of being a really, really good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound about right to you?
Sure.
Because sometimes, like, nah.
I mean, they're all serviceable films. The Master of Disguise was never won an Oscar.
Robbed. No one talks about Crash, you know.
Yeah.
No one, except that. Oh my God, I can't believe Crash won. Like,
and even movies that you like. I personally liked Gladiator when it first came out.
I love Gladiator.
Yeah, but now I have this more critical eye, and that's why I picked Chicago. Didn't make my official list because I watched it before I had a critical eye.
Mm, okay.
So there you go. That's my honorable mention.
All right, number four. You said it in jest, but I say it for real.
Oh, no.
Now, here's the thing. I do have a critical eye. A hypercritical eye.
Yeah.
And the movie of Rent is not particularly great. However, this is not the best ever, as in, like, it should win an Oscar. This is what's important to me. And the reason that Rent makes my list is that I always knew Rent was a thing. You know, it's one of the most iconic musical pieces of the last 40 years. You know, it's a hugely important piece of theater. But I always knew it existed. I knew the 525,600 minutes. Like, that's all I knew. I didn't know anything of it, and I never really had the opportunity to see the show, and there wasn't a movie of it at that point. And then the movie came out. I was like, fine. Well, I just kind of want to know what this thing is roughly about. You're like, you know, the scenes and whatnot. And it was my first experience. I was way older than I should have been to have seen Rent for the first time. I was like, I don't know, 20 years old or something.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, man, I know this movie isn't as good as the play, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because then I think, like, the next year, I then saw a touring production of Rent. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is way better.
This is way better.
But it's still important to me because I think this is one of the most important things about bringing stage shows to a theatrical release is, like, I was just raving about Hamilton. And if you live near New York, you can go see Hamilton and you'll spend $1,000 to go see it. If you live near Chicago, I just looked it up, a ticket on, like, a Wednesday night starts at, like, $200.
Ugh.
So, I mean, you're talking $500 for you and someone to go see Hamilton. Once you make a movie out of it, even if it's not quite as good as the original, it is now available to the masses, you know? And there is something very important to be said for that. So, I fully admit that the movie Rent is not phenomenal. I know that. But I love the music.
The music's good.
It's an hugely important piece of theater. And the fact that this is now, I think it's on Netflix or whatever. You can stream it. You can go buy the DVD for a quarter somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's
everywhere. So that's why it's important to me, is that it, like, filled me in on a piece of theater history that I didn't get to have, I suppose.
I liked Rent, the movie. My main criticisms were that when they weren't singing, I just didn't care.
And it's so rare that they're not singing in the movie. Singing in the show, period.
Well, in the play, it's singing from beginning to end, almost.
Yeah.
But in the movie, it's this massive set piece of a song, and then a couple minutes of dialogue, and then another massive set piece of a song.
Yeah.
And, like, those are all done really well. That's one of my criticisms. My other criticism is I just couldn't buy these 40-year-olds.
Yeah.
Being like, I don't want to pay rent.
Yeah, and that's... And so the two sides of that sword is that they got almost all of that original Broadway cast back together.
Yeah.
Like Idina Menzel, and they got the guy that was on Law and Order, and Taye Diggs, and they got a bunch of them. But then at the same time, you're like, oh, it's been a minute, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It has been a minute.
Still not paying rent, guys?
Wow.
Still not paying rent.
Instead of being like the young, hip New Yorkers, you're kind of like the old fucks, aren't you?
You're just the old grumps.
We're not paying rent. Then get out of here.
Yeah, and I think, what was the other one? Oh, I'm not a fan. I'm going to say this, and I hope it's correct. I almost want to look it up before I say it. I think the writer, John Larson, is that who wrote Rent?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think he died. He passed away before he could complete it.
Yeah.
And I feel that the show as a whole could take another few passes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is also correct.
Mm-hmm.
Also, all of these criticisms are very valid.
All right.
That's why it still sneaks in at 4.
Hey, this is why 5 and out is great. It's our opinion, Steve.
No, what I say is fact.
Oh, I see. Well, my number 3 is a movie called Noises Off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This is a hilarious show and a hilarious movie. And I feel like when lists like this are brought up, this one is never mentioned. But I think it totally captures the humor and the energy of the play. And for those of you who don't know, it's about a... It's basically a show... the movie is basically split up into three acts. The first one is, like, a rehearsal of a play. The second act is the backstage of a disastrous run of the show. And then the third act is... Well, again, we are seeing the stage, a disastrous run of the show. But what makes this adaptation so great is because they have these comedy giants like John Ritter, and I'm blanking on everybody else's names now.
Monica Bellucci is in it.
Yeah, exactly. And then Christopher Reeves is in it. Is it Reeve or Reeves?
Christopher Reeve.
Okay. Thank you. Michael Caine has a surprisingly hilarious turn in here. Like, it is so good, dude.
So this came out, what, early 80s then?
I'm going to look it up.
On the Google machine. So does that bring me to my three then?
That brings you to your three. That's how numbers work, Steve.
Wow.
I don't know words.
I do not get these numbers. My 13 is...
Oh, boy.
Again... did you find your info there, Wes?
Don't keep stalling. So, 92.
92?
Yep.
Wow. Okay, about 10 years off on that, baby.
Yep.
All right, so the reasons for Rent being number 4 are largely the reasons for this being my number 3 as well. Okay, never saw it. Huge, huge piece. Finally brought it to my attention in a way that I could consume it. Also nominated for Best Picture. Also won an Oscar for an actress. Do you know what it is, Wesley?
It's Les Miserables.
Les Miserables is Les Miserables. Yes, this is Les Mis is my number 3. Again, a giant in the world of theater. It's one of the shows, you know. And I know a couple of the songs, you know, that sort of thing, but I'd never seen the whole show.
Sure.
And again, I didn't have the opportunity. It's not a thing that colleges put on. You know, there's too many people. There's too many things. The show is too expensive to do. The cast has to be, God, like 100 people. It is an enormous show. It goes on, it's like 3+ hours. But there are some jams in this. Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly why Anne Hathaway won an Oscar for her rendition of My Heart Will Go On.
That one, exactly. Sweet Dreams Are Made of These.
That's it.
Yep.
That's it. Annie Lennox. Mm-hmm. She won for that song. And Hugh Jackman, I thought, did a really good Jean Valjean. Russell Crowe.
Ooh, boy. Was he in that movie?
Oh, my God. So there's this huge moment in the play, in the musical, where Jean Valjean, our protagonist, our main character of this huge show, he's an escaped convict that turns into this gem of society. He's such a God-fearing man. He gives all these opportunities to people. And then Javert, the detective that's been chasing him for years and years and years and years. And eventually... Jean Valjean saves Javert's life, and Jean Valjean says, "You're free. I don't need anything from you. Go on." And Javert cannot live knowing that he owes something to Jean Valjean, and he kills himself. Mm-hmm. And it's this big moment. And when Russell Crowe plays Javert, and he kills himself, you're like, finally! Oh, my God. I thought this scene would never come. And you've got some very, very talented actors and actresses in this. But you've got Hugh Jackman. You've got Anne Hathaway. You've got Eddie Redmayne before he won his Oscar for something else. You've got dudes and ladies that can do this thing. And they can sing. And they can do it pretty well. And then you've got flat-ass Russell Crowe. Like, and Javert is not an undemanding vocal role.
Yeah.
Like, you got to have some pipes to do anything in Les Mis. Russell Crowe ain't got it, dude.
No, he doesn't.
He ain't got it. And we were talking about Rent being beginning to end singing. Same thing with Les Mis. There's no dialogue. You know, the whole 99% of the show is singing. So when Russell Crowe can only sing, he's done for.
He's done. Yeah, I think. Now, I don't remember him singing a full song. I remember him starting to sing a song, and then an extra shoved him off the bridge. Is that not what happened?
I remember him starting with a few notes and then just kind of like song talking. It's like, one day more, we will lead them to heaven's heavens. Like, what the come on, man.
Russell.
Come on. From a multiple Academy Award winning actor.
Yeah.
Even more time nominated. Like, he's a good actor.
He's a really good actor.
This is not the role for him.
No, I don't know how he got it either.
And the other thing I like about Les Mis is pretty much in all musicals up until this point, you can tell when they're filming it, they are playing the music, and they're lip syncing it as they're filming the actors.
Yeah.
And this is one of the very first films ever that they sang live as they filmed it, mm-hmm. with these very well hidden mics and ear monitors and that kind of thing, so that what you see is what you get, mm-hmm. when in the film is that pause, that moment of acting, if you will, that's how it was on that take. So not every take was the same. They didn't use this canned music to do it. I appreciate that part of the filming process as well.
Sure.
So
for the most part, that paid off.
Yeah. And if only they could just dub over old Russ there.
Some ADR, maybe.
Yeah. So Les Mis, number three for me.
My number two is a movie that I was introduced to a few years ago that I loved.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Did you know that it's a stage play?
I did not.
No, you might not know this is a stage play, though. Have you ever heard? Okay, the movie is The Birdcage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that a play?
It's an adaptation of, I looked up how to pronounce it, it's in French, La Cage aux Folles. So it's a French name, it's a musical, and it's the same story, it's just it's a non-musical version of that, and it's an English name.
Really?
Yes.
I love The Birdcage.
Oh, it's great.
Birdcage is a hidden gem, man.
That is how you spell it.
La Cage aux Folles.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, the cage of follies.
The cage. I thought it was birds, but apparently it's. I you know what? I don't know. I don't know French.
No, it's great.
Yeah.
No, it's the Birdcage is a. I mean, that's a top five Robin Williams movie for me.
Oh, it's wonderful. And it's Robin great. Williams at his peak. Nathan Lane kills it. Even
Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman.
Matthew
yes.
Broderick. No, that's not his son. No, it looks like Matthew Broderick. Actually, the best performance in the whole thing. Hank Azaria.
Oh, yeah!
Hank Azaria as the maid butler guy. He's fantastic.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. For those of you who don't know, first of all, watch the movie.
Yeah.
It's about this couple is getting married, and the man's parents are two men, and the female's
Nathan
parents
Lane
are...
Robin Williams.
Yes. The female's parents are staunchly conservative people.
And one is a politician running for, like, Senate or Congress or something like that. And that's Gene Hackman and...
Monica Bellucci.
No, the woman who was married to Harrison Ford, really skinny...
Amanda Peet.
No, what? No!
I don't know!
Continue.
Carrie Ann Moss.
No, goddammit!
And so the man asks his parents to try and act straight, and he has to, and it's a series of funny situations, humorous set pieces, and crazy ass characters like the aforementioned Hank Azaria. It is so much fun, and it has a great ending.
Calista Flockhart.
That's what I said. Carista and Ma Flockhart.
Got it.
Yeah. And then, so...
This movie has... It's great physical humor with Hank Azaria. There's great, like, verbal humor with Nathan Lane. There's also great kind of, like, trying to do the old, like, swapper, like, hide someone behind the curtains as someone comes through the front. And, like, there's... It kind of hits on all classical levels of comedy, which is great.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this had to be... on my list, The Birdcage with a Bullet, my number two.
That's great. I had no idea that was based on a play.
I know it's a musical. I don't know if it started out as a straight play or what.
All right. But so, anyway. Number two. This is a bit of a cheat. Slightly a bit of a cheat. Number two. 10 Things I Hate About You. Well, in name, it is not a direct play. But everybody knows that 10 Things I Hate About You is The Taming of the Shrew by William Shakespeare.
Sure.
That's what the movie is. And the high point after The Secret World of Alex Mack for Alex Mack.
Oh, totally.
Who is a huge childhood crush of mine. Oh, my God. And then great performance by Heath Ledger in there.
Oh, yeah.
And
Julia Stiles.
Julia Stiles. Like, this was prime teenage hot people doing a great, great adaptation of a great, great play.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen it.
Really?
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, quite honestly, it's one of the best, like, of our era, like a teenage kind of movie. It is absolutely one of the best and one of the ones that would hold, like, I will show my daughter that movie in the bag. Look, I know the hairstyles are a little goofy, but just go with me. The story is from, like, 1600, okay? So let's go with me here, okay?
It's, sure.
It's great. It's just so well done, and it's one of those things that when I was, I don't know, 13 years old watching, I was like, man, this is great. And someone was like, by the way, I just snuck some William Shakespeare in your life. You're like, wait a minute. Hold on. It's like eating ice cream. And then somebody's like, by the way, that was frozen yogurt and it was good for you.
No!
I loved it. I loved every second of it.
Who am I?
What have I become? It's just great, man. And like, I mean, cause I close on my list was the Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes? Is that her
name? Sure.
The Baz Luhrmann, yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio, Romeo and Juliet. But that was very Baz Luhrmann. It was very dramatic, very big, very. And 10 Things I Hate About You was much more like, hey, Shakespeare, y'all.
Yeah.
It's accessible. I was like, God damn it, it is. It's just good. It's great. Great movie. Holds up now just as well as it did 10 years ago.
Well, maybe I should give it a shot.
You really should.
All right, man. Well, that brings me to my number one. This is the only musical on my list. It had to be Little Shop of Horrors.
Ah, yes.
This is the first live-action musical I ever saw.
Yeah?
And I was like, oh, my God. When I saw it when I was 9, 10, 11, I don't know, I loved it so much. The songs were catchy as hell. And I was like, what? And this is also a show?
What?
And I grew up in a small town, but from 10, when I was 10 years old and younger, I lived in like
a shoe.
What I'm saying is I didn't know anything about Broadway. That's what I'm trying to say. And so I was like, what? There's live action stage musicals? And this brought me into my current love of theater today. The Little Shop of Horrors was that door. Because I loved it so much. I was like, I could act in this someday, maybe?
What?
And what is this musical? This is another great musical. And, you know, Rent? What's Rent?
It was your gateway drug.
It was.
Nice.
So, and of course, the Little Shop of Horrors movie is a great adaptation. Great performances from Alan Green, who was in the stage show, the original cast recording, Rick Moranis as Seymour.
Steve Martin, right?
Steve Martin as the dentist. Yep. Oh, my God, he was great. And Levi Stubbs as Audrey, too, killed it. And, yeah, man, I just loved that movie, even if it wasn't a stage show beforehand.
Yeah.
It was a great movie.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Good pick. Good
Thank
pick.
You.
And I know you have a deep place in your heart for that.
Yes.
Number one. My big number one. Going with the musical here again, in that it is about music.
Oh.
And it is another one that won Best Picture, 1984, I think.
Okay.
Two actors nominated for Best Actor that year for this film.
Okay. A musical about music, nominated for Best Picture, two actors nominated for acting awards.
You got a guess? I was in it when we were in school together.
Meet Me in St. Louis?
Amadeus, Amadeus. Amadeus, Amadeus, Amadeus. Amadeus. I love the show Amadeus, and I love the movie Amadeus. It is, again, this is a thing that goes, it's a combination, this is the best kind of combination, I think. That's something that is really good, but it also touches into that, like, nostalgic part for you somehow, so mm-hmm. you get that, like, multi-layered love of something. And so, when I was a kid, my mom used to play, like, Beethoven and Mozart a lot for me. A lot. So, eventually, like, I was always interested in classical music. I never did anything to pursue it in any way. I just always really liked it.
Sure.
And then I saw the movie when I was sometime in my teenage years, so I wanted to knock out a bunch of Best Picture winners. And I was like, wow, that is an incredible film. And everything about that film is incredible. The costuming is incredible. The film editing is incredible. Cinematography, like, it's everything in that film is fantastic. And your two lead actors, because it's like it's a co-lead show. There's Salieri and there is Mozart. And for those who don't know what the story is, basically, Mozart is, he is divine inspiration. You know, mm-hmm. he is gifted from the gods with the most incredible talent the world had ever seen. And Salieri, who was a prominent composer and player at the same time, he's the dude that had to work for it. Mm-hmm. He isn't gifted like that. He has to grind. He thinks he makes something great. And then all of a sudden Mozart just improvisely, and here's the world's greatest symphony. He's like, how? Oh, no! So it's this combination of religion and jealousy and like natural talent for like in finding your place and what's good enough, and it really fleshes all of that out. And then I read the show in college, and then I was able to be in the show in college and had a great time. It was with great friends, and it was a great show. And so it hits all these notes. And I think if you have the ability to go see that show sometime, which it is rarely put up, but if you can, go see it. If not, it's been on Netflix for like 10 years.
Oh, is it on Netflix?
I mean, I'm sure it still is. It's been on there for so long. It's one of those movies when we talked about a Best Picture gives you an 85% chance of being a great film. This is one that keeps that number up. It is great. It is a great film. You will not be disappointed if you watch it.
I have never seen it, but if it's on Netflix, I might give it a shot.
It's awesome. I highly, highly recommend it. It is by far the best film and best by far the best film on my list. No doubt about it.
All right. Well, my top five in review. My number five is Arsenic and Old Lace. My number four is Frost Nixon. My number three is Noises Off. My number two is The Birdcage. My number one, I'm sorry I burped, Little Shop of Horrors.
My number one, I'm sorry I burped.
The classic Tony Award winning.
Monica Bellucci at her best. Number five, Frost Nixon. Number four, Rent. Number three, Les Mis. Number two, 10 Things I Hate About You. Number one, Amadeus.
Amadeus, Amadeus, oh, Amadeus. Oh. All right, so guys, we, and ladies, we only picked... Well, nine, to be honest. And there are so many stage-to-screen adaptations, so we want to hear what you guys think.
You know what? I make my list. You know, I kind of get my group of things that I think will be in play, and then I kind of arrange them. And then I go online, and I kind of check some other lists to make sure that there's something that I'm not just way... I'm like, oh, my God, how did I forget about that?
Oh, sure.
Like, best movies about being in a Matrix. I don't know. And, oh, God, how did I forget The Matrix? Stupid.
Yes.
And I forgot how many, like, old-time movies there are.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
40s, 50s, 60s. We did it all the time, man.
Yeah.
You're prominent on Broadway, you're getting a movie. Oh. That's how it goes. Neither of us mentioned The Sound of Music, like King and I.
Yeah.
Like some of the old school classic stage to screen stuff. Because honestly, The Sound of Music is the best one.
Sure.
It's the best one.
I mean, it's the most well known.
It's not my favorite, but it's the best one.
And I mean, I'm glad Shakespeare kind of appeared
on
your list.
Definitely made an appearance.
Mm-hmm. And there are so many adaptations of his works out there.
Yeah.
And so many other classic playwrights like David Mamet and Neil Simon have so many adaptations that I don't think either of us picked any of their stuff. Unless Neil Simon wrote like Hajafha.
Actually, he wrote Amadeus. Not true.
No,
he did not.
Oh, boy.
It's Peter Schaffer. Anyway, so there's still a bunch out there. And again, these are things, it's more interesting to me what's important to you as opposed to what do you think Hollywood says the best one is.
Good point.
So, please, you can leave a message here at oneofus.net.
You can email us at, it's a new one, remember, 5andoutshow@gmail.com.
That's right. So we'd love to hear from you. We love to respond to your emails.
Oh, see, before we end the show, one quick announcement. I have a Twitter account that I'm going to start using more now. And if you want to follow me, I'm at TheWesWhitaker on Twitter. Steve, do you have a Twitter?
I do. I signed up for it years ago. And every once in a while I get an email. It's like, hey, do you want to tweet? And I'm like, shut the fuck up, Twitter!
Like an ex-girlfriend, like, hey, are you still thinking of me?
Get the God damn it! I hate Twitter. I absolutely loathe Twitter.
Man, you hate all forms of social media.
I hate social media in general.
So, well, don't follow Steve.
Follow me at The Real Raging Asshole. Yeah. So, Wes will be handling the social media for Five and Out. So, what's the handle again, Wes?
The Wes Whitaker.
That's right. So if you're a fan of the show and you want to, you know, reach Wes directly and me secondarily, hit him up.
Sure, sure. But with all that being said, I'm
the real Wes Whitaker.
I almost forgot how we end the show. Steve, take it away.
I'm Steve.
I'm Wes.
That was Five.
And we're out.
Ladies and gentlemen, listeners to oneofus.net, be a subscriber. If I could offer you only one tip for the future, being a subscriber is it. The long-term benefits of being a subscriber at oneofus.net have been proven by scientists, whereas the rest of my advice has no basis more reliable than my own meandering experience. I will dispense this advice now. Watch TV, but not too much. Remember to cast a wide net of types of shows you watch. Even reality TV may have the occasional gem to offer. Don't feel too bad that you have trouble finding friends that share your interests. You are amazing, and you should love what you love. Sure, in 20 years you'll look back at your favorite stuff and cringe at some of it, but it will be with an affectionate smile. By the way, I have no doubt that you probably look amazing. Even if you haven't found that person yet, if you believe in yourself, somebody is going to love you. I'm sure anime is great. I don't personally watch a lot of it, although some of our staff certainly does. You'll feel better in realizing that my lack of interest in it isn't me critiquing the quality of anime and affects your love of it in no way. Tony is probably not gonna show up. Yeah, we wish he would too. Love that guy. Taking it personal when someone likes something you hate or hates something you love in entertainment is understandable when young. But as you get older, trust me, there will be little that will make you feel more embarrassed about yourself than cruel things you said on someone's Facebook page about DC versus Marvel or whatever at 3 a.m. At least hopefully. Write. Create. Do your own thing. And if you don't have the time, find the time. Try out the shows you haven't given a shot to yet on our network, like Thumbtacks and Screwjobs, Somebody Likes It, or Deliberations of Doom. We think you'll be pleasantly surprised. But seriously, trust me on the subscription.